I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source, a radio conversation modeled on the mind of William James and on the ever-active web at radioopensource.org. We're talking this hour with the biographer Robert Richardson about the philosopher and psychologist William James, who in almost a century since his death has never lost currency. The public intellectual whose ideas about religious belief, about the nature and the process of thinking, and also very public and political issues like war and imperialism, keep him alive and set a sort of gold standard of high, penetrating, popular, and serious style. This is the short course on one of our favorites, with one of our favorite chroniclers, Robert Richardson's book on William James in the maelstrom of American modernism, makes a trilogy now on Thoreau, Emerson, and James, three great New England minds that have never really left us. Post up your own notes at our site, www.radioopensource.org. Welcome, Robert Richardson, to Open Source. For you and your readers, there's an extension, maybe a completion here, on the heaviest of 19th century hitters. For starters, just place William James in the company.
Oh, it's wonderful to be here. Thanks. William James comes at the end of the 19th century. He comes at the turn of the century. He doesn't die until 1910. He lives through the Boer War, the Philippine War. He's a man who's left a stamp on modernity, but he has his roots deep, deep in the 19th century. His family knew Emerson. Emerson was a frequent visitor. There was a room in the James house called Mr. Emerson's Room. So there's always been a sort of visible link between the two.
And yet so many differences, and maybe the word modern is the key.
Well, the differences are enormous. When William James was a young man, he looked on Emerson as his father's friend, and he would sort of smile at Mr. Emerson. And there's a slightly satiric side to William James's early references to Emerson. But later, he came to read Emerson after he, James, had lived through some of the difficult and dark parts of his own life. And he came back to seeing that there was much more in Emerson than he had thought. And so he came around to some of Emerson's points of view. So he wasn't so much the early teacher as it was a later meeting on a much disputed battleground coming from two different directions.
I was thinking also, there's a complexity, there's a darkness in James that's quite different from the early ones. This man called himself depressive from time to time, neurasthenic. He'd had suicidal thoughts of the pistol in his 20s, he wrote. He was also, as Emerson never would have been, he was open to drugs, to quackery, to every kind of modern, shall we say, experiment.
It's true. William James had an astonishing openness to experience, and it's impossible to say exactly where he got it, but it's evident through his whole life. He told Gertrude Stein, never reject anything. It's the beginning of the end for an intellectual. And he never rejected anything. He was apparently capable of walking into a room, seeing a beaker on the edge of a chemistry table, and tasting it before he even knew what it was. This is a man with an extraordinary ability to risk things.
And gases and pills and
ingesting all sorts of dangerous substances, as his brother once put it, his brother Henry the novelist. The risk-taking he later made a point of. He said, we really only look to people who are able to take risks in life, which is interesting.
There are so many key words about William James, and you've just struck one of the big ones, experience. We've got to talk about what he meant by belief, what he meant by temperament, what he meant by the keynote of an individual, what he meant by the ground of a person's joy. Such incredibly straight-ahead English language, unscientific words, which are so appealing because we know he's dealing with the depths of human mystery.
He brought philosophy to ordinary people, and without condescension. He was a very great thinker, and he was much respected by the other major thinkers of his day, but he had this uncanny and much cultivated ability to talk to ordinary people in accessible language, as we might put it. If he believed, as he did, for example, that there really is no way to distinguish, finally, between where the mind stops and the body begins, that this famous mind-body dualism may not be a dualism. It may be a continuity. There may be nothing but the body, part of which seems to act like a mind all the time. He could say this in ways that didn't lose you in the difficulties of the terminology.
Bob Richardson, sketch your own route to this man through Thoreau and Emerson, but as a seeker and a biographer yourself.
Well, when I first thought about 30 years ago about trying to write a biography, it was going to be a biography of William James. And I admired William James because I had read wonderful things about him, about how we never use our best energies. We are always acting below our best threshold of possibility. And I thought, he's right. There are things in all of us that we don't usually get to, but he seemed hopeful about the possibility of getting to them. James is finally a very tonic, intoxicating speaker and a writer that way. So I thought he would be a wonderful person to write about. He writes about the energies of people and where they are. He talks about the hidden self. He talks about the stream of consciousness, which became the whole way modernism went at art, particularly the novel. And his brother. So I looked at him as the possibility of a biographical study, and after a while, I just drew back in horror. I just could not do it. I didn't know enough about the history of medicine, the history of psychology, the history of philosophy, the history of the study of religion, and field after field after field. And
this
French
is partly, I should
German.
Say, because you're a biographer who feels compelled to read everything that your subjects read. That's a big library.
Well, it's true, and I fudge on it a little bit. I can't say I've read everything that they read, but I do try to read as much as possible of what they read, including the small and unimportant stuff. I try to read the children's books that they read as children and get some sense for what goes into the production of the great writing of people like this. It seemed like a different way to approach biography that would make it perhaps intellectual biography, but again, not inaccessible. Books in, and then you turn around and write.
When did you decide that this could be possible after all?
Well, after I had written and published biographies of Thoreau and Emerson, and it was the mid-90s, and I was not getting any younger. I thought, all right, now or never. If this is a man I admire and he says take risks, then take a risk. Do it. It's like Mary Moody Emerson saying to all the young Emersons, always do what you are afraid to do.
We got to keep three William Jameses in mind throughout this whole conversation. There's the philosopher of pragmatism, the man who said the truth of an idea is in its outcomes. There's the psychologist of the streams of consciousness, as you've said, the active mind, inseparable in a way from the processes that deliver it, the neural pathways, they would say today. And then third, perhaps most current of all, is the student of religion, who examined the will to believe quite apart from churches, from scriptures, from whatever else is out there. He vindicated it as an essential human activity. Where do you want to begin on the big three?
And the big three. Well, one of the things that ties them together is that they're all about experience. And another thing that ties them all together is that they're all about the mind. Just take experience first, because he's not only the philosopher of pragmatism, he's the philosopher of something called radical empiricism, which is much less well known and not so much written about except among philosophers, but is a philosophy which says that experience is really all we have to go on, and therefore that's what we should base everything on. But the other side of that is that nothing that we experience can be excluded either. So everything that we have in the way of dreams and hopes and possibilities, all those things that come as experiences, are part of the essential part of life. J. James was always interested from the very beginning. He begins as a psychologist. Actually, he begins as a physiologist.
He begins as a painter, too.
And before that, he wanted to be a painter. And his painting is full of gesture, and he painted people. He painted faces. He painted bodies. He painted things in motion. He painted things with energy that are loaded with expressiveness. And he stopped that very abruptly right about the time of the Civil War. He and his brother Henry signed up for the Civil War but never served. Their younger brothers, Bob and Wilkie, did serve in the Civil War. The youngest sibling of all, Alice, was not eligible for the Civil War. But the idea of that the mind is based in physiology, that the brain is based in physiology, that everything that we talk about as experience and philosophy and religion must begin with the physiological examination of the human being who's doing the feeling on all this. And James is wonderfully clear on this. He doesn't begin out in the cosmos somewhere. He doesn't begin with God. He doesn't begin with history. He begins with a scalpel in one hand and a brain dissection manual in the other. And he tells his students, if you can't do anything else, go and get a sheep skull and a little knife and start cutting and see what you find in there. And he always tries to keep us down on a level of physical reality, physical actuality.
And yet he leaves room for transcendence in religion, and he, even today, can be cited, often is, as a kind of defender of religious reality, no?
That's right, because somehow this mass of stuff that can, in fact, be dissected experiences life. It doesn't just sit there under the knife. When it's alive, at least as opposed to when it's dead, it experiences things, it feels things, feels ideas, responds to things, and it's that wonderful tissue of experience that we're actually interested in, he says.
With the biographer Robert Richardson, we're getting close to a great hero, William James, philosopher, psychologist, religionist, for his time and all time. This is Open Source. We'll be right back.
Hi, this is Brendan. I am the blogger-in-chief. Every show on Open Source is open for public discussion before, after, and during the broadcast. You suggest shows, suggest guests, share your reading lists, and then tell us what to ask. You can call this citizen journalism, or you can call us lazy, but you can find us at radioopensource.org.
Open Source is produced in association with WGBH Radio in Boston. This is Open Source from PRI. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source, in a special conversation today with Robert Richardson, the magisterial biographer of Thoreau, Emerson, and now William James. Bob Richardson and I took a walk through the Cambridge Cemetery the other day, where in the James family plot are buried father, mother, sister Alice, and brother Henry, all interred in a row. I want you to sort of introduce us to just the genius and the joy of this James family project, which is represented here.
Vincent Scully, the great Yale art historian, he said, you know, once you have your dead in a place, you feel like you belong. He was thinking about the white man coming and the Indian and taking over. But once you have your dead in the ground, you belong. It's not imperialism, it's not taking over in some way, but when your dead are here, well, here they are. I mean, these are not the James family. These are our people, our thinkers, our novelist, our psychologist, our philosopher. This is why I find this place very, very moving up here. Here's the old man, the old Swedenborgian, Henry James Sr., and his wife next to him, the two central ones, and then William, the oldest son, and then Henry the next. And the
I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. In a special conversation today with Robert Richardson.
When he was about two, a sort of tragic moment. But it also led William to say just the best statement I've ever seen about how to deal with the death of the body. This is William. To anyone who has ever looked on the face of a dead child or parent, and James had done both, the mere fact that matter could have taken for a time that precious form ought to make matter sacred ever after. It makes no difference what the principle of life may be, material or immaterial. Matter, the material, at any rate, cooperates, lends itself to all life's purposes. That beloved incarnation was among matter's possibilities. Now, that may be a materialist statement, but boy, it's a great one. Matter cooperates with what life needs and wants. This plot is maybe 15 by 20, but it's one of the sort of centers of American life.
I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. In a special conversation today with the biographer Robert Richardson, we're talking about the father of public intellectuals, William James. You write of this rich, unbelievably gifted, various brood, Bob Richardson, this air of gleeful anarchy and uninhibited high-toned hilarity was set by the witty father. We have to be introduced to Henry James Sr.
Henry James Sr., father of the novelist William James, Henry James, and father of the psychologist and philosopher William James and Alice and two other children, was a self-taught Swedenborgian man of enormous wealth and enormous independence, whose father had been one of the richest men in America. Young Henry James Sr., when he was about 13, was playing a game in which a lighted ball of turpentine landed on his foot, burning him so badly his leg had to be amputated. This was in the days before anesthetic. This scarred him his whole life. He had one leg. He walked around with a cork leg all the time. He was, however, a brilliant and astonishing man, and after a run-in with alcoholism and difficulty and almost going under, he recovered, became a Swedenborgian. The Swedenborgians of his day, anyway, believed that there's a complete correspondence between the material world and the spiritual world. I won't go into that because James didn't stay with Swedenborgianism very long. He never stayed with anything very long. He went quickly to New York City on his own, inherited a huge amount of money, never had to work, and started writing books, which nobody really wanted, so he published them himself. The family all lived at home and in the evenings would center around a table, everybody talking together and telling stories, and they would have people in. The Emerson children would sometimes be invited to be at the table, a huge table full of people, all talking and laughing and arguing and going at things together with huge glee and gusto. This story is told one night that the father was writing one of his unread, unwanted, unpublishable books over in the table while everyone else was doing homework. And William was drawing at another table, and he drew a frontispiece for his father's new book. And it showed a man beating a dead horse.
They were witty. They were competitive with each other, the boys. They were joyful. Henry later referred to, this is out of your book, the blessed group of us. And when he wrote about him, he was desperately afraid he wouldn't do justice to the joy of it. One year, I think it was 1902, William produced The Varieties of Religious Experience. Henry produced The Wings of the Dove. How do we account for the fecundity of this family?
It's very hard to know how it can be really accounted for. Much of it must have come from the mother. Much of it clearly came from the father. Much of it came from the
surroundings. Mama favored Henry, Papa favored Willie.
William, exactly so. But the mother was also very careful with the kids. What she did was hold the family together by writing letters and telling people what to do next. If somebody was absent from the family circle for a while, she would write letters and say, so-and-so is feeling this way. You need to write a letter to Henry to make him feel better about this. And she demanded letters from everybody who was away all the time. So a huge strain of this went through the mother. They were an Irish family. They had come in the end of the 18th century to this country, where the grandfather had made a huge amount of money. Among other things, he bought a town called Syracuse because there was salt underneath it. And the family continued to own land out there for a long, long time. But just ancestry and just education doesn't do it. There was some chemistry to the Jameses that made them, as one of them remarked, a nation. That William belonged to the James nation.
Henry was almost unflaggingly productive. William went through long digressions, travel, depression, search, recovery, discovery. I wonder where you pick up the thread of his evolving sense of psychology, what the human mind is up to, starting with his own.
It's hard to say. It interested me from the beginning that Henry James is our great novelist of the psychology of the mind, how the mind really works. In all of those increasingly complicated novels, what you are seeing is how consciousness really plays itself out. And as you grow up, you're able to read the longer novels more and more. And William was doing the same thing. So they had the same subject in many ways, which was consciousness in all of its edges. William makes much of marginal feelings and the beginnings of feelings and shadowy feelings. He'd say, for example, when you are trying to think of a certain word, the gap that it has in your mind has a certain tone that no other missing word quite has. He's terrific on this stuff. He seems to get interested in psychology when he was having a great deal of trouble deciding whether he was sick because he felt badly or whether he felt badly because he was physically sick. And he seems fairly early to have come to the conclusion, at least this far, that you can never exclude the physical. And he drew an important line for himself there in which he was unwilling to posit that there was a mental realm and then there was a physical realm. He always seemed to feel that the two were tied together and that you abandoned the physical world at your peril.
All of these words, consciousness and mental process, how the mind works, are absolutely current today. But I wonder, what is the William James piece of the modern outlook on them?
Well, there's several. There's small ones like the James Lang theory of emotion, which is that you run away from a bear not because you're afraid, but you're afraid because you're running. He thought that many emotions, not all, but many emotions actually have their beginning in a physiological reaction, which sets off some action, and that action then produces what we call the emotion. Peeling an onion is an example. You peel the onion and the thing causes your eyes to water a little bit. And as your eyes start to water, you begin to feel sad, even though you're just peeling an onion. It doesn't work in all cases, but it works in some. Another and much larger thing that he's famous for is putting his finger on the stream of consciousness. And that's not just as one little aspect of how the mind works, but he says that is what the mind does, and that's all it does. All we have, each one of us, is a stream of experiences, of moments of consciousness, and they're not even things. They're not separate. There's no way you can pull them out and put them on a table. It is a process. It's pure process. So the beginning of what's later called rather grandly process philosophy and process theology is right here in James's notion that all we've really got is the process. All we've really got is the experience of the moment. He once came and put it in a very tantalizing but I think succinct way in which he said we may, in trying to think about who is the thinker and what is the thought, what is the thinker and what is the thought, he said we may be able to get no further than this, that the thought itself is the thinker.
And yet he's rather clear about truth. In Pragmatism, he writes, true ideas are those that we can assimilate, validate, corroborate, and verify. Mm-hmm. False ideas are those that we cannot. Truth is simply a collective name for the verification processes. Truth is made, just as health, wealth, and strength are made in the course of experience.
It's a very practical and very modern sense of truth. Truth for him was a process. It was more a verb than a noun. He liked to talk about the process of truing. A carpenter takes a piece of wood and a plane and he trues it. That is, he makes it level if he's trying to make it level, or he makes it a right angle if he's trying to make it a right angle. He smooths it if that's what he's trying to do. But in the process, he trues the board. That's the old workman's language for what you do with a piece of metal on a lathe or a piece of wood in a shop. That's James's notion of the truth. It's something that proves out, that becomes true in the living.
Nothing about William James seems more contemporary, really, than the varieties of religious experience. The whole assertion that whatever the churches and the scriptures had come to, that the religious impulse was anything but spent, as we see in our own country, but we see it around the world in the headlines every day. What was this business, this process of belief that William James did so much to vindicate?
Well, where he starts on that is with the idea that religion is the religious experience of an individual, so that you cannot really talk meaningfully about religion as the product of a creed or a church or a prophet or a series of prophets or even a god or a series of gods. Religion is religious experience. Now, he doesn't say that everybody has the same religious experience at all. He has a whole variety of kinds of experience of holiness, experience of conversion, and experience of change.
What were the outer limits of his own experience of religion, Bob?
He's very careful not to give personal experiences that can be interpreted as religious. He's very careful because he doesn't want to be co-opted into one or another camp or one or another form. But it's fairly clear that he had things that we would call mystical experiences occasionally in his life, as I think do most people. This is one of the things that Emerson and Thoreau both insist on, is that mysticism is not something that's special to a few 14th century religious figures gifted and alone, but it is something that everybody is potentially capable of. James does tell a story of being lost in the mountains out around Keene Valley in the Adirondacks in New York, and having an experience where he couldn't sleep all night long and was watching a bonfire, the sparks ascending to the sky, and he felt so wakeful that he felt all the gods of German Walpurgisnacht churning in his soul. It's clearly some kind of religious experience. He's careful elsewhere to remove himself from this, but he clearly underwent what we would call conversion experience, from a period in which he felt so hopeless that he thought the only thing to do with life was to kill himself. And he worked his way out of this. The central idea that you can be converted, you can convert from one thing to another. Not only from atheism to religion, you can also convert from religion back to atheism. You can be converted to miserliness. Conversion is, like everything else in James's world, a process. It's not a thing that's a particular goal. You can't tell where you're going to come out on it, but it is something that happens to the human being under certain circumstances. And it is that fact that it's possible to convert a life of misery and depression and inwardness into a life of outward-looking happiness or reasonable living. This gives one hope. James's refounding of religion, and it really amounts to that, through this wonderful book, The Varieties of Religious Experience, 1902, given as lectures in Scotland and then repeated in this country and then put out in this book that has never been out of print. His refounding of religion is to say that religious experience is the ground of it. That's where it really is to be found.
And he's made himself, in a way, or he's been made the model of Alcoholics Anonymous as a conversion experience, as a reach out to a redemptive mystery. How does that illuminate what William James was up to?
Bill W., who founded Alcoholics Anonymous, says that William James is the unacknowledged founder of AA because Wilson was reading William James when he got the idea for AA. And it was James saying of conversion that the real change doesn't come until you reach the bottom and you accept and admit that you are helpless and hopeless. And once you have accepted that, once you have given up your own strengths such as they are and said, I need help, at that point something can change. And that struck a note for Bill Wilson, too. And he immediately wrote off a letter to another psychologist, Carl Jung, who wrote back much later and said that, yes, this was where this kind of experience would have to be. It would have to come from the individual.
What would William James's take be on the frequent citation of spirituality as opposed to religion as a focus of real but rather vague interest?
Well, he believed in the possibility of spirits. He believed that we may have a life after death. As he told Gertrude Stein, never reject anything. What is concluded, that we have a conclusion? Who are we to say that all of the evidence is in and that any of these things are impossible? And he would cite examples of things that we just couldn't know. He has a wonderful example. He says at one point that we are in the universe the way our dogs and cats are in the library. The dogs and cats see the books. They see the physical books. But they have no idea what's behind those, what's on those shelves. So he says we are in the universe. We see the stars. We see all this stuff. We see all these other people. But we don't know what's behind there.
It may be apocryphal, but I find it nonetheless endearing that on his deathbed, William James asked his brother Henry to linger in his house on Irving Street in Cambridge for 6 weeks or so, just in case he could be in touch from the other realm. We're talking about the late, great William James with the biographer Robert Richardson. We'll be back. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. In a special conversation today with the biographer Robert Richardson, who immersed himself in the life of William James for 10 years before giving us William James in the Maelstrom of American Modernism. We took a walk recently through Harvard Yard, where William James kept his office as professor of philosophy. Bob Richardson, in the shadow of Seaver Hall and Emerson Hall and the Harvard Yard, remind us of William James, the lifelong teacher.
He was a great teacher. He started out teaching anatomy and dissection. He was actually teaching people to take apart cadavers in here. And he became a very great classroom teacher and lecturer. But it's not just as a Harvard professor somehow that he registers as a teacher. He went around to all of the new women's colleges that were sprouting up at the time and gave wonderful talks there on what makes a life significant and the energies of human beings, and was received with wonderful, rapturous ovations at these schools. And he was very proud of being able to speak to these new women's colleges and their ambitions and hopes for life. But he carried it way beyond the college walls. He gave Lowell lectures, and these Lowell lectures were founded in order to do what we would call adult education. Lowell's idea was that New England was such a poverty-stricken, terrible, miserable climate, no natural resources, that it had no future except in education. So they damn well better look to it. So he founded this series of lectures, and his idea, which was a terrific one, was to bring first-class instruction to working people. There was nothing condescending about it. So the Lowell lectures were widely attended. And that's where James gave many of his best sets of lectures, including the pragmatism lectures.
What did he do for Gertrude Stein or any of the other famous students of the period? Santayana.
Well, Santayana was doing a completely different kind of philosophy from James. It was Platonic in nature. And James was capable of calling Santayana's work the perfection of rottenness. But he sent it with this sort of wonderful warmth and smiling generosity. W.E.B. Du Bois came here from the South, and James was very important to his career. Du Bois wanted to do philosophy, and James talked him out of it. And I've been asked whether this was maybe a little racist thing. Did James think he couldn't do it because he was black? But James tried to talk almost everybody out of going into philosophy professionally. He said, if you can do anything else, do it. You will find that a professional life of philosophy is like living with the east wind in your belly all the time. Gertrude Stein was another major student. She was doing experiments in automatic writing. And this was not mumbo-jumbo stuff. The idea behind automatic writing at the time was thinking about hypnosis and about the hidden layers of the self. If there's another self in there, sometimes you can get to it by asking it to write while you're in a light trance. We still use these techniques for eating disorders and things like that. A doctor will say, you know, I'd like to talk to the thin person in there. And it's not hard to see how the Gertrude Stein famous writing style evolves right out of Jamesian notions of what consciousness in fact is. And that wonderful comment that she makes near her own death when she is remembering James as her teacher, it said, what he taught me was to reject nothing because it's the beginning of the end for an intellectual.
There's this quality of William James that you half expect him to come around the corner at any minute. What a joy that would be. And how much we'd all have to talk about.
Well, the energy of it. He was described as a man who took stairs 2, even 3 at a time until he was over 50, going up, not just down. This. He describes a friend of his, Tom Davidson, as always coming towards you with his hand out, with a sort of eagerness to meet you in his eye. And James was the same way. He just lit people up with his enthusiasm and ebullience and this sort of avidity for life itself.
I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. In a special conversation today with the biographer Robert Richardson, we're talking about the father of public intellectuals, William James. Could we talk about the public advocate who applied pragmatism to policy in his day and vehemently, alongside Mark Twain and others, against the McKinley-Roosevelt annexation of the Philippines? The first burst of American imperialism. Some of it, I must say, reads like tracts for this time. Introduce us to that very, very public figure.
It's very strong stuff. James wrote, and wrote beautifully at one point, that not only was he opposed to the imperialism, he was also opposed to mere bigness. He had a feeling for the underdog. He had a feeling for the neglected person in the corner. when he wrote about college and about the true spirit of the college, it wasn't the club members and it wasn't the athletes and it wasn't the big people on campus. It was the forgotten people who labored away in the corners of the libraries. They were the real heroes for him. He was always on the side of the little fellow.
He also left in that extraordinary essay, The Moral Equivalent of War, an extreme, virtually pacifist denunciation of war. We've got to come back to this because of his own experience at a distance, a near distance of the Civil War. But he writes in The Moral Equivalent of War, he says, history is a bath of blood. The Iliad is one long recital of how Diomedes and Ajax, Sarpedon and Hector killed. No detail of the wounds they made is spared us, and the Greek mind fed upon the story. Greek history is a panorama of jingoism and imperialism, war for war's sake, all the citizens being warriors. It is horrible reading because of the irrationality of it all, save for the purpose of making history. And the history is that of the utter ruin of a civilization, in intellectual respects, perhaps the highest the earth had ever seen.
John Dewey thought that we owed William James an enormous debt just for the title, The Moral Equivalent of War, because we've seen that terminology and that phrase used again and again when we have the war on poverty or the war on drugs. We are talking about the moral equivalent of war. Where James is so persuasive to me and so articulate is that among the opposers of war, he is the one who, it seems to me, gives war its due. He is not willing to say, oh, we're all peaceful people, we don't like war. He begins with the fact that we seem to like war. He says wonderfully in there, the war tax is the only tax that people pay willingly. And he keeps getting us on these points. So he is starting out with the strengths of war and with the fact that we are deeply attuned to and fond of war. We like it. We therefore need a moral equivalent of war that is not just an opposition to it, not just saying, oh, peace at any price, or we're not warlike. It is how to get up a warlike spirit in ourselves that serves some other, that is expressed in some other way than carnage.
You know, Louis Menand's book on the Metaphysical Club, what, 4 or 5 years ago?
Wonderful book.
Wonderful book. Conditioned us all to see William James at the center of that metaphysical project. Conditioned us to think of the whole business as a reaction to the Civil War, the off-the-cliff, near-death experience of this Union over ideology, really. Mm-hmm. But the message was every idea must be tested on its effects and its results. This was the kind of the urgency, but the reason for the pragmatist philosophy. And in the Louis Menand history, it prevails essentially from the end of the Civil War till World War I. In an American society in 2007 that seems to have discounted publicly the pragmatist test, what's gone wrong and how do we get it back?
Wouldn't one love to know. And I think John Dewey is as much at the center of that as William James, maybe more than James, though James is certainly in it. The pragmatic view is sometimes called realpolitik. It is the kind of view that asks, what are the results going to be? It has to discount intentions if intentions are separated from results. Pragmatism comes from a Greek word meaning action. It's not all that difficult. But it talks about acting in such a way that you are aware of all the possible consequences and willing to be judged by the consequences. The meaning of something is all of the things that it results in. So it's not enough in foreign policy or in anything else to go in for, quote, a noble idea if you have not spent any time trying to foresee the possible results and realizing that the results are going to be the judgment on this.
Can we avoid speaking about his commentary on the war in Iraq?
Well, it's fairly clear from reading what he said about the Philippine War that he would take the same line on it. We don't understand people who are different from us. And he said this not about Americans, but he's a wonderful essay called On a Certain Blindness in Human Beings. And he said human beings are essentially unable to understand people who are not like themselves. We don't even give each other the same level of reality that we reserve for ourselves. People find it very difficult to think that somebody in the next room is really as real as they are. Now, the political consequences of recognizing this mean that you don't march out to the Philippines or you don't march out to Iraq to tell people how to lead their lives when you don't understand their lives.
Not the least reasons I admire William James so much is just the prose style, which can be funny, discursive, biting, incisive, literary, but repeatedly proving Walt Whitman's line that who touches this book touches a man. William James added that the books of all the great philosophers are like so many men. Our sense of an essential personal flavor is in each one of them, is the finest fruit of our own accomplished philosophic educations. So what is our sense of the man inside this book, Robert Richardson, from his books?
He teaches courage, as Emerson taught. He also teaches, or taught me, that we are free to live as if we were free. We may be free, we may be determined. This world may all be laid out in advance, and it may be known which door I'm going to leave by and whether I'm going right or left on Western Avenue. But I am free to live as if I were free. And James has the wonderful ability to pick those two words up and say, as if. It's a chance. But humanity is willing to live on a chance. In fact, one of the endearing things about people is their willingness to live on a chance, as James put it.
Everybody I know loves William James. There's a great building in Cambridge, William James Hall. He's cited all over the map. But why is it we need still more of him in the 21st century?
The openness to experience is a wonderful piece of it. He believed in looking outward, not inward, although he had had his inward agonies. He is filled with energy. He believed after every visit that he should write a note, whether he was the visitor or the visited. He had some little social graces like that that made him much admired. He was once about looking at a book in the window in Harvard Square, and a student came along, was looking at the same book, and they fell into conversation. They decided the book should be bought. William's wife was away, so he invited the student home for dinner and talked to him for 3 hours before the student realized whose home he had been invited into. He was that kind of man. He was very widely admired and loved because he lived a life full of open and generous-hearted action.
Scientist, philosopher, stylist, where do you put him among the wisdom writers of America, of the whole bookshelf?
Well, for me, he's up on the same shelf with Epictetus and with the great Stoics, Marcus Antoninus, with Samuel Johnson, with Montaigne, with Emerson, because he is one of these people who can teach you how to live. It is still possible to sit down and read, say, his book on talks to teachers and to students on some of life's problems and get a great deal out of this. He is somebody who can talk to today. He is a great teacher, not always recognized as such. He is able to persuade you that you have more energy in you than you have yet learned how to use. He is open to the possibility, indeed thinks of it as the likelihood, that there is a hidden self in there that needs to come out, that you can do more than you've done, that you have more energy. It was Longfellow who once said, other people judge us by what we have done, but we judge ourselves by what we feel capable of doing. And what James does is he makes the individual feel capable of more than when you sat down.
Two other key words I'd like you to just deal with. One is pluralism, and the other is just the voraciousness of his mind. He had lived in 18 houses by the time he was 16 years old and had crisscrossed the Atlantic all his life. Find the root in all of that, if you can, of his open to the plurality of people, the plurality of experience.
It's this openness to change. It's a welcoming of change. if you were going to do a strict intellectual job on it, you might say it came from Darwin. What Darwin teaches is that everything changes. There are no fixed species. One variety changes into another over time. The whole lesson of Darwin is not evolution, the word Darwin avoided in the first edition of that book, but descent through modification, change.
Hmm. And now speak just finally of his range. An incredibly restless mind moving from art to medicine to psychology to philosophy to the study and practice of religion. Did he live in the last era when that kind of boundary jumping could be done with authority and style?
Well, no, I don't think so. He would not want anybody to think that it was the era that made it possible. He wouldn't want anyone to think that it was he alone who could do it. His argument is that any human being can do this. If he could do it, then others could do it too. If it was possible in 1900, it's possible in 2000. There are no limits on us like that. Now, why did he do it? How did he come to accept change instead of fight and resist it and try to fix it? He's a built-in anti-Platonist. We don't know the origins. We do know the fruits, that it had this wonderful fluorescence and that there was nothing he wasn't interested in.
His own anti-Platonism, or his own case against the sovereignty of pure ideas, brilliantly summed up in that sentence, a permanently existing idea which makes its appearance before the footlights of consciousness at periodic intervals is as mythological an entity as the Jack of Spades.
That's exactly right. He did not believe that there is a world of permanent, eternal ideas out there and that we are just sort of little local manifestations. He believed that our experience is all there is, that the whole sum total of human experience is what there is, and it's not dictated by these fixed ideas.
Robert Richardson, it's such a pleasure to hear you talk about William James. I wish you'd lead a William James book club for all of us. But we begin by reading your wonderful biography, William James, in the Maelstrom of American Modernism. Thank you, Robert Richardson.
Thank you. It's been a great pleasure to be here.
You can keep talking about William James. You can help us work on the next shows. You can pitch us a show idea of your own at radioopensource.org, where you can also download any show and subscribe to Open Source as a podcast. Open Source is produced in association with WGBH Radio in Boston. The program is made possible by the Schooner Foundation, whose contributors support the Carr Center for Human Rights Policy at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government, training practitioners and students for leadership in human rights. RadioOpenSource.org is hosted by Contegix, contegix.com. Our show is produced by David Miller, Brendan Greeley, Catherine Bidwell, Chelsea Mers, Robin Amer, and Greta Pemberton, with help from Julia Reichel and Sam Gail Rosen. Robin Moore was our engineer. Mary McGrath is our executive producer. I'm Christopher Lydon. Join us next time on Open Source.
PRI, Public Radio International.